From the Moon Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. This afternoon, the LA Unified School Board scheduled a vote whether to support a statewide moratorium on new charter schools. The district's willingness to approve charter applications has long drawn strong opposition from the teachers' union. This is a central issue in the recent strike. We'll debate a charter school moratorium right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is February 18th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope your day's off to a good start. And my thanks to Libby Denkman for hosting yesterday. I was attending a family funeral and always appreciate leaving the program and her excellent hands. Although I am a little concerned, seems like she gets high before she hosts the program. My desk was way up in the air and my chair, I had to bring it down to my level. Oh, what did you think I was talking about? Thank you, Libby. Always appreciate it. Coming up, an Oxford study looking at the effects of screen time on kids. Frequent Air Talk guest Jean Twenge of San Diego State found negative effects as screen time increased. The new Oxford study finds otherwise. Well, where else but here would we bring the two researchers together to battle it out? Respectfully, of course. That's later this hour. Well, first, if you thought things would settle down at LA Unified after the strike was resolved, no. This afternoon, the school board considers a controversial proposed statewide moratorium on the creation of new charter schools. Will the board support or oppose the proposal? With us, KPCC K-12 education reporter Kyle Stokes. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Larry.
So let's talk about where this stands. This is a proposed statewide moratorium, and the state would control this issue?
That's right. So what the board is asking for today here in LAUSD is to have state lawmakers pass a moratorium, and they specifically say that it should be a moratorium on new charter schools within the LA Unified School District, pending a study of the state laws that allow for the creation of charter schools. And just to sort of back up through some of the particulars of that, the way charter schools, they are public schools, but they don't run through the normal channels of the school district. The school district doesn't operate them, but the school board does need to give permission for these new schools to open every couple of years. They need their permission to stay open as well. And so, but there are very few reasons that the school board has where they could say, we don't want this new charter school to open. There's a very limited set of reasons under the law. And that sort of led to this growth, despite there sort of being these questions from charter school skeptics. Is there room for more charter schools in Los Angeles, or are charter schools crowding out the regular district-run neighborhood schools? And so this has been a solution that's gained favor with state lawmakers now, in fact, and with new Governor Gavin Newsom proposing some version of a temporary moratorium, state school superintendent Tony Thurman talking about a moratorium. This from LAUSD now, this resolution that emerged from teachers' union negotiations appears to be the teachers' union through the school board trying to nudge state lawmakers into addressing the issue.
And of course, state lawmakers, not surprised, would be favorable to this because the teachers' unions have been major campaign contributors to the Democratic majority of the legislature. But in terms of LA Unified's board, with Ref Rodriguez, who is a charter school proponent, being off the board, what does it look like counting the votes, Kyle?
The vote's going to be close for sure. But I've always said that you have to sort of like moderate your expectations. This isn't like the Democratic or the Republican Party when you talk about charter versus non-charter supporters on this board. It is true that the majority of this LA Unified School Board was endorsed by the Charter Schools Association at one point or another. I have always said that things look a lot more complicated than that on the ground. I think there's a possibility possibility that this does pass, despite those leanings, though. And I think that that goes to show you that this board's relationship with charter schools is complicated. The reason I think it might have, it's more of an open question about whether it passes, is that the union came out with language from negotiations calling for a cap on charter schools, which is different than a temporary pause in the creation of charter schools, which is what is actually being proposed, a temporary moratorium. A cap sort of implies there's going to be a limit for now and for forever on charter schools going forward. That's what was the language that emerged from negotiations, and the union signed its signed a tentative agreement with the district saying, would you bring this measure to the board? What instead has been proposed is a resolution that calls for this more temporary solution, and that might be a way to let everybody walk away from this and save face, given the fact that teachers' union supporters have so much public support right now.
Is there in this proposed moratorium a time definite that the moratorium would last, or would charter supporters have reason to be concerned that the moratorium could just be indefinitely extended?
There's not, and obviously that would be a concern. On the other hand, we're a couple of steps away from this actually taking effect. The school board cannot enact this moratorium. They would need a change in state law to do that, and that's why they sort of ask state lawmakers to do this. So there's no there. It does talk about there should be a study of all of the state's charter authorization laws, but it doesn't talk about a timeline for enacting this.
Love to hear from charter school parents. If your child attends a charter school within the LA Unified District, what do you think of a moratorium based on what you've seen and your conversations with other charter school parents? Does it make sense to you that there would be a moratorium to review the regulations, the oversight, the approval process for charter schools within the district? Or do you have the other concern that this would keep charters that parents are looking for to send their kids from being created in a timely manner? 866-893-KPCC. 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Joaquin in South LA writes on the page, charter schools limit UTLA's bargaining power by giving students and board members an outside option. The cap has nothing to do with what's best for students. This charter school provision is cartoon villainy. Again, it's not a cap. It is a moratorium that's being talked about, but as Kyle just said, the time frame of the moratorium is unclear. 866-893-KPCC. If your child attends a charter school within the LA Unified District, do you think a moratorium would be a good idea to allow the district and the state as a whole to relook at the oversight and the requirements of charters or not? Joining us is Mirna Castrejon, President and CEO of the California Charter School Association. Ms. Castrejon, good to have you with us again. Your organization's holding a rally in just over an hour prior to the school board meeting. What are you hopeful that will accomplish?
Good morning, Larry. Thanks again for the invitation. Yes, we are gathering in front of Beaudry this morning to speak up against what we see as a misguided attempt to curb the opportunities that charter schools have been affording, especially in Los Angeles, targeted at serving low-income and Black and brown children who are the strongest beneficiaries of this. This deal was negotiated in the dark of night, without parents present, without charter representation present. But this is a policy lever at which we can direct our voice and raise the issues that we think are most important. A moratorium is not going to solve anything, especially when we most vehemently disagree with the false premise of the resolution. We'd much rather engage in a constructive dialogue around how can we improve together than to arbitrarily use this incredibly blunt instrument to stop the path of opportunity for our children.
If it is truly a moratorium, say, for example, time limited to a year to go through and revamp all the protocols, and your organization or surrogates have a seat at that table, if it really was a time-limited process, would you have an objection?
Well, here's the thing, Larry. We have every reason to be skeptical of moratoria. You'll recall that not that long ago, the state imposed a moratoria on our assessment system, and the API went out the window, and parents have been flying blind to figure out how to assess the quality of schools and how best to make sure that their needs are being met. There was a three-year period where we didn't have any way to assess because the wheels of policy grind very, very slowly and at multiple levels. And if that's the conversation that we want to have, then we're absolutely putting the cart before the horse.
All right. And I also wonder about the input that you feel you've had before this vote, as Kyle Stokes was just reporting. You've got a number of members of the school board who are pro-charter. Have you been in conversation with them? Do you have any sense of where they're leaning on this vote?
Well, first, I would characterize the board as being pro-kid. And to be sure, as Kyle very aptly put, there's a lot of nuance in each board member's priorities and orientation. Of course, we have been talking with board members across the board. We've had almost 4,000 families engaging directly with board members to advance the notion that this resolution does not get at the core issue of achievement, and that we have common ground in looking for those solutions. And we're happy to come to the table to sort out how can charters be helpful in that conversation, but this solution isn't it.
Again, I'd love to hear from you. If you are a charter school parent, what do you think of a potential moratorium on the creation of charter schools within the LA Unified School District? 866-893-KPECC. Michael in Del Rey said, I'm on my way to the demonstration right now. I'm outraged by union leadership who say they're doing everything for children when they're really only serving their interests. As a father of a student in a charter school, I feel this is a direct attack on my daughter's education. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You can also tweet at AirTalk, where Bong Bong tweets, charters were only created because of the demands of parents. The LAUSD board is beyond corrupt. Recall and fire anyone connected to this self-serving effort. Robert, messages on our Facebook page. For-profit schools are never a good idea. These companies are about making money, not about educating our children. Just correction on that. None of these are for-profit. They are all non-profit entities. Some of them are large non-profit entities or larger than just individual campuses, but they are not for-profit. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Norman Lakewood says, so much drama. This is not closing existing charters. No, but I'm sure Michael in Del Rey, who called saying he felt this was a direct attack on his daughter's education, depending on where she is in school, this could have a potential effect on her future higher grade level school that she might go into if a charter was available for her. Perhaps it's not at this point, and Michael is looking for the creation of a charter that would serve his daughter down the road. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Kyle Stokes, do you have a sense of the kind of lobbying that's been going on with the school board members in advance of this afternoon's scheduled vote?
Well, on one side, there's obviously the teachers union, which pushed for this as part of its strike resolution with the school district. And it's worth noting that they saw, even though charter schools were not really the central issue on the contract table itself. A lot of their demands were oriented to making the district more competitive with charter schools. For instance, class sizes, a lot of people, on the picket lines and union leadership said that the reason that they wanted to reduce class sizes was make it so that more district classrooms were occupied, had students in them, and thus making it harder for charter schools, which can by law use a portion of district campuses as sort of basis of operations. It's a way that charter schools get started. The class size piece was designed to prevent charter schools from having more classrooms where they could get a foothold. The union has definitely been heavily lobbying. And in fact, the existence of the resolution shows that there's been heavy lobbying from the UTLA side. But obviously, the Charter Association is pushing back very heavily. And the demonstration we're going to see is something that we've seen a lot when charter schools have had policy issues threatened, or when charter schools have been threatened with closure. Very often, supporters come down in droves. Sometimes the schools send them down in droves. They provide buses to allow them to get down easily to the school board site and to make their voices known and have these demonstrations just like this. So there's been heavy lobbying from both sides, at least in the public space. Right. And so that's been an issue. That's definitely a factor here on today's vote.
We'll continue our conversation with KPCC K-12 education reporter Kyle Stokes. I welcome your calls in advance of the rally that's planned by charter school supporters in front of the Beaudry headquarters building for the LA Unified School District. They're gathering at 11:30 this morning for that event. At 1 o'clock, the school board scheduled to hold its meeting. On the agenda is a resolution for the school board members to consider, calling for a moratorium, have to be done at the statewide level, but whether they support or not, a moratorium on new charter schools in the district. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. The future of charter schools in the LA Unified School District, as we heard from the president and CEO of the California Charter School Association, Mirna Castrejon. Charter school proponents are concerned that a possible moratorium on charter schools will become an ongoing ban on the creation of new charters within the LA Unified School District. We're taking your calls at 866-893-KPECC. If you're a parent of a charter school student, I'm interested in your thoughts on whether you think there would be value in a moratorium to review the process of approving and overseeing charters within the LA Unified School District, or whether you have the same concerns as the Charter Association that this will essentially become a ban on creating new charters on an ongoing basis. Sylvia in Glendale, good to have you with us. What do you think?
I'm a substitute teacher, and what I would like to say is that the core of the demand for charter schools, and they are indeed public and nonprofit, as I'm glad you corrected, is education. It was a demand for better education for the children, for the students. And so if the education aspect of LAUSD schools was actually addressed better, there would be less demand for charter schools. So the core is the issue of education for children.
I think the view of the union, though, is that parents are drawn to the charters, but they may not necessarily be getting a better education. That the parents are kind of flim-flammed, I think, is part of the argument, and they go to the new thing, but that they would be better off staying in their neighborhood school. Your response to that?
Because a lot of the charters are in the neighborhood. They are in part of the schools that are part of LAUSD. They're on the physical campuses of them, and I think the unions are cross because money is drawn to the public charter schools rather than to the neighborhood schools. But if the neighborhood schools had been better to begin with, the demand would not be so great. So the answer is, just as a strike, it's to help the numbers, the classroom numbers, and the pay, and all these things that hopefully will contribute to better education, will stop the increased demand for charter.
Sylvia, I appreciate your call. Thanks so much. Kyle Stokes, KPCC K through 12 education reporter. On this issue, you know, the teachers union makes a number of critiques of charters, but one of the big ones is that they're really not overseen, and that many of the charters are substandard in what they really need to be providing. Has the union quantified that, or are there specific recommendations they're making in how the charters should be overseen?
Well, so the statement that they make is unregulated charter growth. And so there are multiple, you know, layers of that. One is that, yes, there are critiques that the charter schools are not able to be adequately overseen. And we have multiple, you know, examples in recent times. And you know, whether or not these constitute a trend that you know, should raise suspicions about other schools that are currently operating as charter schools right now, or whether these are the bad apples of the bunch, you know, I think is sort of a matter of perspective. But, you know, you could go through the list. You've got Ivy Academia, you've got the Puck charter schools, the questions that have raised around them. They were tied with Ref Rodriguez, the school board member who was forced to resign. There were questions that were raised about conflicts of interest related to Ref Rodriguez, and that goes back to Puck, and that's one of several issues that they've had in the recent past. You know, you sort of go through the list of schools, now called the ESANA network, previously the Celerity charter schools that were raided, whose headquarters were raided by the FBI. So there are concerns about charter schools that are under-regulated in terms of their finances and in terms of their corporate structure and whether or not public money is being used efficiently. The other part of their argument is unregulated charter growth, in that there is no mechanism to stop charter schools from opening where they might not, you know, maybe have a market, where maybe LAUSD, you know, they have to vote to allow these charter schools to open, and maybe they've got another school that they are trying to start in that neighborhood, a magnet school or a special school of choice. But there isn't really a mechanism under state law where the district can say, like, we already think there are enough schools in this neighborhood, or why don't you start this school across town. There isn't a mechanism in state law to say that. Now, the numbers of new charter schools that are opening in LAUSD have slowed. But that said, there isn't really much that LAUSD could do if a qualified applicant comes forward with a quality application to open a charter school in a neighborhood. Even if there are a lot of other local LAUSD schools there, there isn't anything the district can do to say, we don't think that this school should open in this particular neighborhood.
Kyle, if the district moved to a proactive approach, which is sort of what I'm hearing in UTLA's critique, in other words, instead of waiting for things to possibly go wrong and then acting, that the district would be, you know, sort of hanging over all the charter schools, regularly checking their financials, you know, providing a kind of administrative oversight, that would require presumably additional administration to do that. But UTLA has been against extending the size of the district's management team. So how do they square that?
Well, so that's a very good conundrum that you pose, but I think it's important to also note that there are district regulators who do this. They go through and every so often will audit the schools. I believe they do annual oversight visits at charter schools. They take a look at the academics and the finances. They give ratings to the schools so that the schools get feedback from the district about how they're doing. They raise questions around things like finances. And a lot of the questions that were raised around some of the schools that I just listed were found by the charter schools division. The question has always sort of been, well, is that effective oversight? Is, you know, what happens next? Who are the higher authorities that can compel change? Is the school board itself willing to sanction or even close schools that are bad actors or have been proven to have these problems through this regulatory process? But yeah, the question still remains, Larry, and you're right to key on it. Does the district have enough regulators to, you know, match the size of the charter sector in the district, which is the biggest by the number of charter schools? It's the biggest charter network of any city in the country. There are more charter schools in LAUSD than any other school district. And the question of whether or not the regulators have enough man and woman power to cover all of those schools is a question. And I think one of the concerns that the unions would raise around this sort of concern of, quote unquote, unregulated charter growth.
Lyceum Village tweets at AirTalk, public schools are a failed operational model, and they're trying to stop charter schools from competing with them to protect themselves. Public school systems need competition to get better. We pay the property taxes, but have no lever to hold them accountable. That's Lyceum Village tweeting at AirTalk. Let me go back to California Charter School Association CEO Mirna Castrejon. What do you think is the opening, if any, for greater oversight by the district of charter schools so that they're not in simply a reactive position when things go wrong, but they can see red flags with charters earlier?
Sure. Well, I definitely think that those mechanisms do exist. As Kyle pointed out, the division, the charter school division within LAUSD is one of the most robust in the country. In fact, it was recognized by the National Association of Charter School Authorizers as being exemplary. I mean, it's certainly true that in the end, what is enough is a matter of opinion. But, you know, to the question of unregulated growth, LAUSD routinely denies half of the petitions that it sees. And the mechanisms for closing down or revoking a charter school, either for operational mismanagement or low performance, full power is on the authorizer to do it. So it's not like they don't have authority to do so. But again, I mean, the reality of it is I just want to make clear that when we're talking about Los Angeles, the charter school sector here in Los Angeles is delivering on its promise to close the opportunity and achievement gap. The majority of schools, according to Credo, are delivering better results, sometimes significantly better results, than neighborhood schools.
What is Credo?
I refuse to see this, the Stanford Institute for Research. That's their most recent study where they saw that charter schools not only are succeeding at delivering better performance results in math and English language arts, but also in placing in preparing students for college. But the real issue is this, right? The question is, do we have enough achievement in Los Angeles? I think the answer is no, and I refuse to believe and buy into this argument that it's a zero-sum game. We want to and should be thinking about how best we can partner, but we're going to need each other if, in fact, the Angelenos are going to rise to meet the promises of this historic strike and do it with our wallets. I think this is a very, very poor time for sowing additional division and pitting voter against voter and parent against parent. And I am telling you that as a Latina, as an immigrant mom, I see that our charters are providing opportunities for students who would otherwise not have it. And never in the long history of the fight for equity has that noble goal been advanced by taking away opportunity from the least advantaged.
All right. Kelly in Long Beach says, my husband and I are lifetime educators. We think the charter schools siphon students away from regular public schools and then decrease the quality of education for those who are left behind. Kyle Stokes, that's also one of the arguments that UTLA has made, is that the charters end up with the higher performing students, and the lower performing students are the ones left behind in the neighborhood schools. And it sort of perpetuates the cycle that then the charters outperform because they have the higher performing students as the input. So we also have a listener ask a question, JSK, how many charters have been shut down for poor performance? Kyle, do you know off the top of your head how frequently charters have had their charter revoked?
I have a chart right here, and there are the number of times charters are actively closed is very, very rare. The number of times that their petition for renewal is denied is also relatively rare. There's a chart that maybe I could just retweet for the ease of it and look on my Twitter account, KY Stokes. Back in 2017, I put together this because there was a question about renewals and denials. And you can sort of look at the visual. It's kind of striking how many renewals, which is schools that are already open but need permission to stay open, how many renewals clear through the board on an average year versus how many petitions or for both new schools or for schools that are looking for permission to stay open get denied. You can usually count on one hand in any given year the number of schools that are already existing or that have gotten to the stage of board approval that are denied. I'll just retweet that right now, KY
okay,
Stokes,
sounds
so you
good.
Can see that.
All right. Thanks, Kyle. And of course, for the board, they're in a position where they have to be concerned about the parents who have their kids in those charters. Do the problems at the school, are they so serious and unfixable that it's important to, you know, not renew it because even if that means students finding other schools, because you're putting the education of those kids at risk. That's obviously a big decision.
Yeah, it's an incredible, and this is why, you know, we're talking about, obviously there are some teachers union, you know, supporters who would prefer that charter schools not exist because they have philosophical objections to them existing. But the practical reality is that about a one out of every five students in Los Angeles attends a charter school. And so, I think that the idea that these schools now fill a very important niche, and parents have voted with their feet to an extent to go to these schools. Now, you know, we can debate the implications of that and whether that's a good or a bad thing. But when you're talking about closing some of these schools down, it causes immense displacement and disruption. And that's, as you say, whenever it happens, you know, parents come together and say, but I believe in this school, even if the financials are not good or the academics are
we can fix it, and all in the district has to figure out if that's really doable. Kyle, thank you so much. As always, appreciate it. KPCC, K-12 education reporter, will be reporting on that vote on the resolution by the members of the LA Unified School Board. They meet at 1 o'clock this afternoon. My thanks to the president, CEO of the California Charter School Association, Mirna Castrejon. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll talk about screen time for kids. What kind of effect does it have on their emotional well-being and their academics? That's come after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Good to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's going well. Got a lot to talk about in our second hour, including a proposed legislation that would scale back the state excise tax on marijuana sales and would suspend a cultivation tax on marijuana as part of its legal market. Now, those taxes were part of selling the legalization of marijuana in California. But the concern is that the illicit market, the underground cannabis market, is still so big because of the big price differential. So we'll talk about whether it makes sense to lower the taxes to try and lower the retail price of legal cannabis or not. Next hour on Air Talk. Right now, our focus on the effects of screen time on young Americans. Noted San Diego State University psychology professor and researcher Gene Twenge has been with us frequently on Air Talk for very interesting research into screen time. She was lead author of a study that's determined screen time might boost depression and suicidal behavior in teens. And she's author of the book iGen, Why Today's Super Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. But a new study that's come out of Oxford University takes issue with some of the research done by Professor Twenge and comes to a different conclusion about the sense of well-being and emotional state of young people who spend more time in front of their screens. With us is experimental psychologist and director of research at the Oxford Internet Institute, Andrew Shabilsky. Professor, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
So first of all, let's talk about the methodology here. How does this study that you've done at Oxford differ from not just Professor Twenge's research, but other research that's been done in this field?
Right. So our group has been kind of trying to crack the nut of, you know, what makes these kinds of environments fun and engaging, maybe leading to some excessive use, and trying to figure out how it impacts well-being for about the last 15 years. And, you know, basically what we've been trying to do is trying to figure out how psychologists have been getting screens and games and different types of media like rap music or heavy metal that parents get very worried about, kind of how psychologists keep getting this wrong. And really kind of this has kind of required us to get kind of pretty inventive about taking and borrowing methodology from behavioral genetics, epidemiology, these other kinds of fields, which have kind of have much more experience working with big data. And so the basic idea here is that we want to kind of try to remove researcher bias, conscious or not, from the analysis of data and try to equip parents and policymakers with the kind of evidence that they deserve.
And how much of that is related to just a larger sample size, that you're looking at a much bigger scope in the study that you conducted?
A bit. You know, you have to think of, you know, Mark Twain's expression, lies, damn lies, and statistics. What really happens here is that, you know, when you have big data sets with tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of participants and hundreds of variables, there really are kind of like billions of possible analyses you could do. And if you have an idea about screens that they're good or that they're bad, it's very easy for us to read our kind of non-conscious biases into the analysis. So even very, very small effects, if you're kind of trained with basic behavioral data, to work with basic behavioral data like you would in a lab, if you then apply that approach to kind of these giant data sets, what happens is you wind up going down some pretty inaccurate paths.
Let's talk about your conclusions. You looked at you know, what the effect of more screen time meant, and you found negligible effects on young people's sense of well-being?
Yeah, so we tried to do this a bunch of different ways. And so these kinds of these big data sets, they kind of ask a load of questions. They either ask a kid or a parent, you know, how much time do you spend playing video games or on social media or just holding a device in your hand? And you know, you can chop this a bunch of different ways. And so what we kind of try to get a sense of is, you know, no matter how you chop it, what is kind of across these millions of different analyses you could do, what's the average effect? Like, what if you're going to compare this to something like listening to music or being bullied, you know, where does social media time or screen time fit in that kind of typology? And kind of judged against that, you can assume it's a rounding error. But you know, that's not to say that there isn't, you know, a lot that's very interesting to study here. It's just that kind of the kind of fears that we're putting into parents are probably overblown.
How does it compare? You mentioned bullying, for example.
Yeah.
I don't know if you looked at smoking or other things. So how do they compare?
Well, you have to be real careful here because something like smoking doesn't really have an effect on well-being now. So some kinds of things, you know, might not even look that bad in a teenager. You know, if someone has a beer or something, that the damage that does actually winds up happening later in development. So, you know, compared to smoking, who knows? But I mean, compared to bullying, it's less than a fifth the size of being cyberbullied, which itself is, you know, a fifth the size of being bullied face to face. And compared to things like listening to music, it's about a 13th the size, mostly because most kids who say they're listening to a lot of music are probably doing so alone. And really kind of, you know, when compared against protective factors, like saying that you're in a household that kind of, you know, is linked to, say, a very like an enlivening religious community, or your kind of family has pretty high integrity, you know, these things are dozens of times larger in terms of their positive effects.
So we do see an increase, if I'm not mistaken, in teen suicide, in depression, mm-hmm. all these factors. So does that then point potentially to the differences in what they're experiencing on social media? Yeah. Is social media itself not inherently important? What's going on?
Yeah. Well, so that's a really interesting question. So this is basically kind of part of the enterprise of science is both to answer the questions that everybody has, you know, myself included as a parent. And another part of it's kind of to ask if that question's really a good one. So if we don't look at like a handful of data sets, you know, if we don't just look, if like we say we look at the CDC data that tells us that suicides are relatively speaking up, you know, really fractions of a percent. If we broaden the scope to kind of look at a period of time that includes the 1990s and the 1980s and the 1970s, what we can actually see is that the early 2000s were a blip. They were a dip in the American experience leading up to the 2008 financial crash. But I think the really key thing here is that you actually have to look at young people in different parts of the world. And so in advanced economies like that are very technologically saturated, more than the United States, like Japan and Korea, and here in the UK and in Germany, we actually don't see the same trends in those time periods. And I actually should correct myself. In the UK, we have seen it, but that more has to do with the deterioration of the social safety net.
Where, of course, they're spending more time in front of screens. I've, Sam, deeply heard the talk shows. You have to ask if that's a good question or not. You indicated it was.
Yeah.
All right. We'll continue.
Well, no, I'm just saying I'm that. Sorry. I'm just saying that in places like South Korea, teenagers used smartphones, you know, almost 10 years earlier than in the United States.
Yeah.
And those kids have been looking good this whole time. Well, and so the real question is, are we actually focusing on kind of the wrong structural thing?
All right.
When we worry about suicide.
We'll continue our conversation with experimental psychologist Andrew Shabilsky. He directs research at the Oxford Internet Institute, Oxford University. Jane Twenge, aforementioned noted researcher from San Diego State, frequent Air Talk guest, is going to join us coming up. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in just 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by San Diego State University professor of psychology Jane Twenge, author of iGen, Why Today's Superconnected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. She's lead author of the study Screen Time Might Boost Depression, Suicide Behaviors in Teens. Professor Twenge, good to have you with us again.
Thank you.
So first of all, your response overall to the critique here that there were methodological problems with the study you conducted.
Oh, not at all. And I actually don't think that's what he was referring to. What he said was that they used this statistical technique to kind of consider all the different ways that you can analyze this data. What's interesting is I've worked with two of these data sets for more than a decade. The third is new to me, but I've been working with it for the weeks after their paper came out. All those data sets showed the same thing, pretty much no matter how you analyze them, which is that twice as many of the teens who spend a lot of time on digital media are depressed and have suicide risk factors and are unhappy. So, I mean, the most alarming of all and one of the most consistent findings that you get no matter how you cut the data is that twice as many who spend 5 or more hours a day on electronic devices have attempted suicide at some point in the past compared to those who spend 1 hour.
All right. And when you look at other developed countries like the United States and screen time, do you know if this holds up internationally?
So it definitely holds up in the UK. They've found, you know, there's some pretty big spikes in anxiety and depression, especially among girls. There are increases in suicide rate that follow the same pattern in other European countries, for example, in Sweden. It's true in Asia. You're not seeing quite the same trends with those increases beginning around 2012 like in the United States. It's not entirely surprising because the impact of technology is going to interact with culture. If, for example,
those teens in Korea or Japan are still seeing their friends as much face-to-face, or they're still getting enough sleep even though they're spending a lot of time on phones. That may not have as big of an influence on well-being as it has here in the U.S., where we know for sure teens are now sleeping less and spending less time with their friends face-to-face since the smartphone became common.
And how much do we attribute that to the smartphone? How much do we attribute to other factors like, you know, more demanding coursework, greater competition to get in college, all these other factors that have come along at the same time as screens?
Yeah, and that's always the challenge in doing research like this on cultural change. You can document a trend such as this large spike in teen depression and suicide. It's always a harder question to answer why that might have happened. It's very clear that it's not increases in coursework, because these same surveys ask teens how much time they spend on homework, and homework time is either unchanged or down since the 80s and 90s. It's unlikely to be increased competition for college, because extracurriculars also pretty much unchanged, and these trends show up among kids who aren't even thinking about going to college as well. As for other factors, there's always, you know, possibilities, but very few things follow the pattern of teen depression, which is that it was either unchanged or down during the 1990s and 2000s, and then right around 2011 or 2012, it begins to go upward. That doesn't follow the pattern of the economy. It doesn't follow the pattern of income inequality, which has been rising linearly since the 80s. It doesn't follow the pattern of any big political upheaval. The other thing is smartphones and their use. That's not something that happened around the world or across the country that teens read about. It's not even something that happened to their parents. It's something that happens to teens every single day for hours at a time, that the way they spend their time outside of school has fundamentally changed.
The Oxford study indicates that there are these other factors that are more influential than screen time on the emotional states of young people, and bullying with a much larger negative association, and that, you know, regularly eating breakfast, getting enough sleep, that these have much more of an effect on the mood, sense of well-being of young people. Would you disagree with that, or do you think that's true along with the conclusions of your study?
Much more the latter. So I'll also point out in the same data set that the association between getting exercise and well-being is actually less than the association between spending a lot of time on electronic devices and well-being. Does that mean we shouldn't exercise? Of course it doesn't. There are many influences on well-being. Some of them are stronger than others, and some of the influence is going to vary from person to person. I don't think that's a relevant question. So the relevant research question here is not what are all of the possible causes of well-being. Well, most of those are going to be things like genetics that we can't change. So let's focus on the things that we can change. And I think sleep is a great example. Absolutely. Sleep is absolutely crucial for mental health. But guess what we also know? The kids who aren't getting enough sleep, at least in some cases, it's because they're staying up late on their phones. So this is all interrelated.
Mm-hmm. Professor, always good to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us today on Air Talk.
You're very welcome.
We appreciate it. That's Gene Twenge of San Diego State University, psychology professor and author of the book iGen, and lead author of the study Screen Time Might Boost Depression, Suicide Behaviors in Teens. We appreciate it. And let me go back just briefly, Professor Shabilsky. Quick response on Professor Twenge making the point that this doesn't appear to be linked to economics or the downturn.
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of interesting to me as a fellow psychologist, because we're really not trained to do that kind of time series analysis. So you can kind of plot points and kind of say, oh, this is or isn't correlated in terms of pictures on a page. But, you know, really, this this method of trying to figure out how things are correlated is very haphazard unless you're a specialist. You know, there's a direct correlation actually between the number of Nicolas Cage movies that are released in a year and the number of bathtub drownings in the United States. It's one of the strongest correlations in human history. But it doesn't mean that we can draw these kinds of inferences about screens.
Fascinating. What Nicolas Cage movie. All right, Andrew Shabilsky, thank you for being with us. University of Oxford, and he's director of research at the Oxford Internet Institute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Got a lot going on in the second hour. I'll tell you about it momentarily.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. A little bit later this hour, the ongoing debate about Burbank Airport, the noise from the airport, as well as the reconstruction of the big terminal there and its 14 gates. Some residents have concern that rebuilding that terminal for safety reasons will ultimately end up having negative effects on the neighborhood with larger jets, more traffic, and more noise for the nearby communities. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But first, we turn our attention to legal cannabis. And the question is whether the taxes that were implemented to provide for the regulation and for revenue generation for legal cannabis have instead allowed the illicit market to flourish while the legal market has struggled to compete. State Treasurer Fiona Ma and four legislators have introduced a bill that would cut the state excise tax on marijuana sales from 15 to 11% for a three-year period of time and would suspend the cultivation tax on growers of $148 per pound, also for a three-year period. Joining us is Jared Kylo, president of United Cannabis Business Association, an L.A.-based industry group. He owns the Higher Path Collective, both a medical and recreational cannabis dispensary in Sherman Oaks. Jared, good to have you back with us today.
Oh, thank you, Larry. Appreciate it.
I know there are a number of factors which make it challenging for legal cannabis to compete. How big an issue is the excise and cultivation tax?
Well, I mean, when you're adding that much money to the final price, taxing really does become one of the major issues about trying to compete with an illicit market that just doesn't have these overhead and costs. So to have legislators look at lowering these taxes, like other states have lowered taxes to kind of compete with the illicit market, we're seeing that they're recognizing that there is a lower amount of sales in California and they're going to have to find a way to compete. And lowering these taxes gives all the consumers a break in total cost.
Having hosted many debates on Prop 64, the legalization measure, one of the big facets that was touted by proponents was all the taxes that could be generated that are lost because of the illicit market. So if you diminish or remove these taxes for 3 years, doesn't that in effect undermine what voters were sold?
You would think so, but we've seen in other states when they reduced taxes, there was actually an increase in revenue from taxes that was generated just because when you have the amount of illegal operators and the illicit market that's in California. We're trying to transition them into the legal market, and there needs to be kind of a safe transitional space for them when it comes to pricing. And if pricing is the biggest deterrent to go back to the illicit market, then yes, we have to be a little bit more eyes open to see what we can do to make it more competitive. When we look at prohibition, when alcohol came out of prohibition, there was very low taxes and there was very low barriers to entry for people to enter into the new legal alcohol market. And after 80 years, we've now seen that they've kind of slowly added taxes and they've slowly added regulations to where we have a very mature alcohol kind of distribution means. And I think cannabis should kind of take some of those same routes.
Well, what about the state costs of the regulation of legal cannabis? Because part of the tax collection, right, goes to fund that infrastructure to regulate the market. Is that going to be a problem to be able to fund the testing of cannabis, the oversight, the licensing, all of that?
Well, right now we've already seen that there's probably about $500 million less in sales than we had in 2017 when there wasn't even a recreational market. And all the other states who had recreational markets had huge increases in sales and huge increases in revenue. So what we're dealing with now is we're trying to see can we lower the tax, be more competitive, and actually increase the amount of legal sales in California, which should increase the amount of tax revenue generated by the state. So I think we can look at some of the other states and see their methodology and see some of the outcomes of their lower taxes and having higher remittance of taxes just by the total volume of sales.
We're talking with Jared Kylo, president of the United Cannabis Business Association, based in Los Angeles. He has his own collective, the Higher Path Collective, which he owns. It has both medical cannabis and recreational cannabis dispensed from its Sherman Oaks location. Also with us is Rosalie Licardo Pakula, who is co-director of the Drug Policy Research Center at RAND Corporation and a health economist. Thank you very much for joining us. Your thoughts about this proposal to lower the excise and the cultivation tax?
Well, thank you very much, Larry, for having me with you. I recognize that the state of Colorado had a similar concern about the size of the black market in their legal market. And in July 2017, they lowered their sales tax, their state tax on recreational marijuana, from a level of 10%, which is actually below the level that we're proposing in the is being put forth by the state treasurer, to 8%. And it didn't get rid of the black market. Other things that actually, yes, there was a rise in tax revenue, which people say, we'll see, then that's evidence that people are coming to the legal market. But there was also evidence of increased prosecution and revenue started declining until the state got rid and significantly reduced home cultivation. So I think the story is a little bit more complex in terms of strategies to get rid of the black market. It's a legitimate concern that the black market, it's hard to get rid of when it existed before we created this legal market. But there's many strategies for doing so. And I think cutting the taxes is not necessarily the most effective way of accomplishing that, because it does, as you mentioned, lower the available resources for doing the necessary regulation of a legal market to ensure that the consumers are getting the high-quality product that they believed they could get through a legal market.
And Rosalie, I didn't quite catch which state cracked down on home cultivation?
Colorado.
And so did they essentially ban it or just limit the number of plants that could be grown?
They basically limited the number of plants. Up until January of 2018, even after the cut in the tax on marijuana in Colorado, patients in Colorado could grow up to 99 plants still. They dropped that down substantially to 6 plants. And that's when we start to see a reduction in the signals of the black market.
Is the theory that they were selling to their friends and that once they limited it to 6, it became just for personal consumption?
That's the belief. We don't know definitively, but fundamentally, we don't know that the people who are growing 99 plants were only growing for themselves.
Okay. And what is the limit here in California on the number of plants that can be grown personally?
Under the recreational adult use law, it is 6 mature plants. Under the medicinal law, there's actually allowances that allow medical registered patients, people who go through the process of becoming registered for one of our conditions, to grow, with a doctor's recommendation, 24 plants, and in some cases even more, depending on their condition. And so I believe that another strategy for tackling the black market that might be more effective than our first going towards a reduction in tax revenue, which I think is something that we need to actively enforce: impaired driving laws, our regulations, compliance with the regulations, is more of a concentrated effort to reduce excess growth and production in among medical patients who now have more dispensaries at their disposal to go get their products. They don't need to be growing 99 plants at home.
We're talking with Rosalie Licardo-Pacula, who's co-director of the RAND Corporation's Drug Policy Research Center. I welcome your calls and your thoughts about this proposal from State Treasurer Fiona Ma and 4 legislators to, for a 3-year period of time, cut the state excise tax on legal sales of recreational marijuana from 15% to 11%, and to do away for 3 years of the cultivation tax on growers of $148 per pound. The idea is to lessen the gap, to make smaller the gap between the illicit market and the legal recreational market, so that people don't choose to buy on the illicit market because it's such a price break. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Jared Kylo of the United Cannabis Business Association, your response to Rosalie's points.
Yes, those would all be valid, but we have a 22 years of having Prop 215. So we have a very robust market that is currently already here and a lot of infrastructure. And to say that just reducing the number of household plants would reduce people's kind of need to go to the illicit market or go into the regulated one, I think is a little short-sighted when we look at how many operators there currently are in California. We're looking at close to 15 million pounds is going to be produced in California this year, and only 2.5 million of it might be consumed by consumers here in California. So we're looking at as a very much a production state. So I don't think production is at a problem. I think we're actually at a fairly large surplus. And if we can't incentivize those 15 million pounds to make it into the regulated market by reducing the taxes, then all we're doing is incentivizing them to go to the black market to make a higher rate of return off of their growth. When we look at some of the costs that are here, 148 pounds for an outdoor grower in a tax is about 20% of their overall tax per pound. A 20% tax on a cultivator who has never had a tax before is a huge increase in their cost of doing business and can definitely reduce their desire to enter into the regulated market if 20% of their revenue is eaten away just by this one tax.
Share some listener comments. Michael from Orange County writes on the AirTalk page, no, do not reduce taxes on this stuff. It was one reason some people voted to allow recreational pot. And how long is temporary? Well, it's 3 years under this proposal. If the industry can't succeed, Michael writes, being taxed, so be it. RTB writes on the page, the state, always looking for a way to get wealthy off the taxpayer, thought marijuana would be a gold mine that would fund all their dreams. Overtaxing just pushed the buyers toward their old ways, the neighborhood dealer. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Kevin writes on the page, many legal shops in California weren't even open for over half of the first year. There should be little question why the tax returns weren't as good as other states or why there's still a black market. Ease restrictions and allow these legal shops to open and run. Rosalie Licardo-Pacula, your response to Kevin's posting.
I agree that the shops have been open slowly and that there's that suggests to me that our revenue, our concern about our comparison of revenue, the basis of the issues of the black market are not well-founded yet. I also believe that the excess production that we know that exists in California already causes substantial declines in the prices that are happening both in the legal market and in the illicit market. Our licensing structure and the rules set up under our new regulations actually increase the cost of production substantially, and I don't disagree with that at all. But these were costs that the market, that the people decided they wanted to do, and we have to be able to enforce them. If we cut the revenue from taxes, we will dramatically reduce our ability to check enforcement of this dual licensing system that we have, both at the state level and at the local level, to be able to weed out the illicit producers. So there's two ways of tackling the illicit drug market. There's a let the free market reign and try to get rid of the black market that way. And I remind the listeners that there is not a commodity out there for which we don't have, because of the internet, a modest black market existing, whether we're talking about tobacco or we're talking about ink for your printer at your home office.
But taxes are a factor in that. I mean, tobacco is a great example because there are people that buy their tobacco products online to avoid California's very high tobacco tax, for example. So couldn't you make the argument, you know, cutting the tax here in California would mean fewer people would turn to, you know, the equivalent of the internet for purchases?
So here's the difference. The price to the consumer for cannabis has been falling anyways, because with legalization came a dramatic reduction in the overall cost of production, both cultivation and bringing the drug to market. The retail price of cannabis is lower today than it was 10 years ago. The incremental taxes that we're imposing on this legal product still generate an average price that is lower to the consumer. So could the consumer who's just looking for the cheapest price cannabis out there find something cheaper? Yes, they can. But will they be insured of the quality of the product and that it's a safe product, which was the justification for legalization in California? And the answer to that is no. So you're always going to have some consumers that are simply just the price shoppers who are going for the cheapest thing out there. Those are not necessarily the consumers that we want to be fishing for the lowest price, because those are usually the ones that are more dependent on the good. We want to encourage a market that is not about the cheapest product out there, but the highest quality product out there that's safe for the California consumer.
Let me share some more listener comments. Miles in Westwood says, I think it's a great idea to lower the taxes temporarily. I'm a recreational user. I had to stop going to my local dispensary because they were doing everything by the book and legally, and their prices were so high that I switched to an unlicensed shop. Allison in Pasadena says, one of the obstacles to any tax revenue or all the city limitations on recreational cannabis. Here in Pasadena, medical dispensaries weren't allowed to sell recreational, and the city is so selective. There are shops that want to pay the tax. That's Allison in Pasadena. And Paul writes on the Air Talk page, lowering the cannabis tax a bit might not be a bad idea, but I think a main contributor to the high price is the incredible slowness with which local governments has responded to the demand for cannabis. In Highland Park, you could bicycle to 7 dispensaries a few years ago. Now there's 1. That's got to contribute to higher prices. The other competition is not necessarily the black market, but people like me and my friends growing. That's Paul writing on the Air Talk page. I want to thank you both for being with us. Thank you so much, Jared Kylo of Sherman Oaks-based Higher Path Collective, both a recreational and medicinal cannabis dispensary. He's the president of the Trade Association, the United Cannabis Business Association. And my thanks to RAND Corporation Drug Policy Research Center, co-director Rosalie Licardo-Pacula. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC, the ongoing controversy over Burbank Airport, noise, the flight paths, and reconstructing the big terminal there. We'll have more on that coming up in 1 minute. I had the pleasure of flying in and out of Hollywood Burbank Airport last week, and always enjoy it compared to the other airports, including LAX here in Southern California. But big changes are planned for Hollywood Burbank. In fact, they're doing their first public scoping meeting today to hear public comments about rebuilding of the passenger terminal there with its 14 gates. It needs to be seismically upgraded. There'll be bigger walkways, indoor luggage carousels. Say it ain't so. I love that little outdoor luggage carousel. More access for disabled flyers, and also trying to make that safer because of how close the runways are to the current terminal. But there are some LA residents who are challenging that plan, saying that the terminal upgrade is going to create some significant problems with more traffic, larger jets, and potentially more noise for communities that already feel under siege because of lowered flight paths that were implemented in the past few years. Joining us to talk about Hollywood Burbank Airport is the mayor of Burbank, Emily Gable Luddy. Thank you very much, Mayor Luddy, for joining us on Air Talk.
You're welcome, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
Let's talk, first of all, about the replacement for the 14-gate main terminal. What effects do you see that having on traffic, jet size, and neighborhood noise?
Well, may I start by first saying that this is the first public scoping meeting that's being conducted by the FAA under the federal requirements for the National Environmental Protection Act. The FAA is conducting the scoping meeting this evening, and it's for that federal agency to prepare its environmental impact statement regarding the replacement terminal. So I'd like to make it clear to you and your listeners that this is not the first meeting. This is the federal step in a series of steps that have been taken over the last 2 years.
All right. And do you see any effect yourself of the terminal replacement on the quality of life for the surrounding communities?
I really think that the replacement terminal at Hollywood Burbank Airport has no relationship to the noise and flight pattern issues that are clearly affecting residents in Studio City and elsewhere. The replacement terminal, which was approved by Burbank residents in 2016, will have the same number of gates as the existing terminal. And as you said in your opening comments, the terminal replacement is really an issue of passenger safety due to the old terminal's proximity to the runways. The new terminal will be three times as far from the center line of the runways as the current terminal is, and it will also meet all the FAA standards because of that separation.
We're talking with Burbank Mayor Emily Gable Luddy about the contemplated replacement of the main passenger terminal at Hollywood Burbank Airport, the FAA scoping session that she's talking about scheduled for later today. Also with us, Studio City resident who's with the community group Uproar LA, which she heads, Kimberly Biddle. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What link do you see between the terminal reconstruction and quality of life issues?
So I think it starts with the fact that they're calling this a replacement terminal when, in fact, the size of the facility will become 50% larger than current sizing. It also includes increasing the taxiways to allow for louder, larger jets, and allows the larger facility also allows for more passengers to be moved through the facility more efficiently and faster. All of those things will equal more noise for surrounding communities.
Well, and if you've flown out of Hollywood Burbank, you know those waiting areas get overfilled. Often the walkway, the causeway is crowded with people. you can understand the benefit of making a bigger terminal, right?
Absolutely. I think that our issue isn't with Burbank Airport itself improving things. Our issue is that the flight paths that we've all been living under have shifted in the last few years, and we're still in a process with the FAA fighting some of those changes. The planes are lower and louder more often every 2 minutes, all hours of the day. And adding to that burden that the community is already sustaining is unacceptable right now.
And you said this would open up the door because of the – are the runways going to be longer as well? Because that's been an issue with Burbank. Rare, but occasional jets that have gone out onto Hollywood Way.
Right. Well, they're saying they're not lengthening the runways. Some sources say that they are, but they are widening the taxiways, which will allow for larger jets than currently can fly into Burbank Airport. And those larger jets are heavier and louder.
So you don't believe necessarily that the wider taxiways are just a safety issue, so there's a bigger buffer between the terminal and the runways?
Correct. Because they're actually moving the whole facility to another location. So those concerns, I think there are definitely safety concerns in widening it, but there are also economic factors driving a lot of these decisions. Because this replacement terminal cost has ballooned from $400 million to $1.24 billion. And they're saying that they're going to recoup a large number of these costs from fees from passengers and airlines that use the airport.
Let me go back to Burbank Mayor Emily Gable Luddy. Mayor, your response to that this opens the door for these larger jets and more people moving through, more traffic and more noise?
Well, I think Kimberly raises the essential question, as you did in the beginning, and it really has to do with the flight pattern of takeoff from the airport itself and not the replacement terminal. My response to the runway extension is California state law already prohibits the lengthening of any runway at Burbank Airport. It's in the government code section. She's right, however, that there will be taxiways put in place so that planes are no longer backing up onto the landing runway in order to move around and move to the takeoff runway. So there is definitely an issue of having enough space for safe maneuverability, but I don't know where the information comes from, honestly, about runway lengthening. California state code prohibits the lengthening of the runway at Burbank Airport, and the controlling factor really will be it's 14 gates and it's going to 14 gates.
So are you saying with 14 gates they cannot move through any more passengers than currently? I mean, if they do accommodate larger jets because of the increased size of the taxiways, doesn't that potentially move more people through?
I think it's a bit of a misunderstanding to say that the taxiways enable larger jets. It is the length of the runway that is the limiting capacity on the size of jets. And right now, the largest jets that are permitted in Burbank Airport are the 737s. Southwest is the primary carrier of those, and the Airbus 320s. So it is a misunderstanding to say that there will be larger jets at the Burbank Airport because of taxiways. Taxiways make it safer for the planes to maneuver their way, get in their queue, line up to take off, or pull off the runway, get in the taxiway, and safely maneuver to one of the 14 gates.
All right.
It's the length of the runway that is the controlling factor.
Kimberly Biddle of Uproar LA, you want to respond to that?
I think that one of the things that needs to be clear is that the number of gates, I understand that we understand it's staying the same number, but the, like you indicated, Larry, the number of people will be increased because the efficiency process is there. So the next gen technology, which is part of the problem with these low flying paths, allows the airlines to push people through and planes through faster, more efficiently, regularly. And that in and of itself is what will increase the capacity of Burbank Airport,
so
not the number.
So let's take Southwest as an example because they're the biggest carrier there. So you're saying because they'll be able to load and unload much more efficiently, they're going to have more flights coming and going.
That's right. They'll be able to schedule more flights. Maybe the planes will be the same size. Maybe they will be larger, but the number of flights per day will increase at this new facility.
But it seems to me, and I could be wrong about this, that I see gates that are open at Hollywood Burbank that aren't. It seems to me the limiting factor on capacity is that Southwest and other carriers now want all those planes to be full for their bottom line. So would they really be adding more flights if it's about what consumer demand is to get a full plane?
Well, I think that if you look historically, for example, Burbank Airport released data that just in the month of November, flights were increased by 5%. The number of passengers and the operations itself increased by 5%. And in 2013, Burbank Airport indicated that over the course of the next few years, there would be about 2.9 million passengers. This past year, there were 4.9 million moving through Burbank Airport. So it's every year at this point now, it's increasing. And just like you said, the bottom line is the airlines want more money, more passengers, and anything that enables them to do that will increase the noise issues in the surrounding community.
Burbank Mayor Emily Gable Luddy, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I'd like to share my perspective on that. First of all, I have a great deal of respect for Kimberly because I am extremely familiar with the sound issues that have developed over the last 2 years, especially in the Studio City and Sherman Oaks neighborhoods. And a lot of that apparently has been driven by a change in flight takeoff patterns from the Burbank Hollywood Airport. So I get that. And both the city of Burbank and the airport authority are on the same side, and that is asking the FAA to reconsider that flight takeoff pattern so that it has less of an impact on those neighborhoods. I get that. The passengers and the number of flights, yes, there has clearly been an increase in the number of passengers. This morning, the LA Business Journal had an article about it. But that is a market-based effect. That's based on people wanting to fly. That is not based on the replacement terminal. That's based on the number of seats that are sold for each plane and whether the air carriers decide whether or not they want to add a plane or, you know, put more people on the same plane as we're all familiar with. That's a market for.
All right. Let me share some listener comments. Dan in Sherman Oaks says, with the new FAA flight patterns, this is not a subtle difference. It's an ongoing assault on our daily lives with planes flying so low and at all hours of the day. With increased traffic in the bigger airport, the problem will only get worse. Heidi in Studio City said, I'm directly affected. Burbank has shifted flight paths over Studio City. We get 300 flights a day over our homes. We have big issues with the expansion. People can't sleep or go outside. It's disrupting our community. And Frederico in Toluca Lake says, I agree with the fact we need improvements to the terminal, but when all the flights are taking off on the southern runway, the cities that own the airport aren't affected by air traffic while we get all of the noise. That's Frederico in Toluca Lake. Kimberly Biddle, thank you for joining us and talking about your concerns. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. She heads the organization based in Studio City and surrounding communities, Uproar LA. She's a Studio City resident. And my thanks to the mayor of Burbank, Emily Gable Luddy. Of course, the airport run by the three cities, Burbank, Glendale, and Pasadena. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Related to air travel is the growing movement to tip flight attendants. What do you think about that? Frontier Airlines is formally endorsing that. Does that make sense, or does it take a very important profession that's very much safety-oriented and turn it into something very different? We'll talk about it right after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. We're just a few minutes away from Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Terry talking with Stephanie Land about her memoir, Made, chronicling her cleaning houses for a living. Made, the memoir of Stephanie Land, Terry's guest. Coming up on Fresh Air here on 89.3 KPECC. Well, flight attendants are asked to do a lot of different stuff. They have an important public safety function, of course, and when an emergency strikes in the air, they're the ones responsible for helping make sure that you keep yourself safe. They also were serving food and beverages, and now many of the airlines are even asking them to sell, you know, sign up for the airline credit card or buy merchandise that the airline is making available. So a lot of stuff flight attendants are asked to do. Frontier Airlines, the cut-rate airline, is now allowing its flight attendants to be formally tipped. Now, there's nothing to keep you from tipping a flight attendant for any airline that you fly, but Frontier has formalized that process. What do flight attendants think about that, and are they okay with that becoming an industry standard? What about you if you're a frequent flyer? Well, at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. With me is CNBC reporter who covers the airline industry, Leslie Josephs. Leslie, thanks for being with us. How long has Frontier been formalizing the tip process?
They actually started having a tip policy in 2015, so this isn't exactly new. What is new is the flight attendants would pool their tips from the entire flight, and starting January 1st, they are receiving their individual tips. So if one person generated maybe $20 in tips, he or she would take that home instead of sharing it with the other crew members.
Do you know if Frontier pays their flight attendants less? Is that part of, does this help to close a gap, or is it just a philosophical difference of this airline?
Well, some of them do make less, I believe, than some of the other larger carriers, but the Frontier flight attendants, and this is important to note, are in the middle of negotiating a contract with the airline, and they're kind of battling Frontier, if you will, to get better wages themselves. They're not trying to say, can you please up our tips or help us get better tips? They want to get a better wage outright.
Does Frontier report how much tip revenue that the flight attendants are getting from this? Do we know how many people do it?
No, we've asked them that. It's not exactly clear how much, but what happens is it kind of like on a screen when you're in a cafe and you order a latte, it'll say 15, 20, 25%. On a screen, and as a passenger, you could choose one of those options.
All right, Leslie Josephs of CNBC with us. I'd like to hear from you if you're a frequent flyer, what you would think about regularly tipping. Do you think that that's appropriate or not? And I guess, you know, it's something I haven't really seen or knew that I was seeing, I guess. I don't think I've ever seen someone tip a flight attendant that I was aware of. But I know that there are people that do it. Do you think it's a good idea or not? Certainly flight attendants work extremely hard, and the things that they have to endure it's remarkable how professional they can stay in the face of some of the things they have to deal with. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I know we have many flight attendants in our listening audience, given the size of our local airports. What do you think about this? Would you support tips on your routes when you're flying? 866-893-KPCC. With us, the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, Sarah Nelson. Sarah, good to have you with us again. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
What do you think about this Frontier Airlines formalizing this process? Would your organization like to see the other airlines do this?
Absolutely not. We're firmly against tipping on planes. Flight attendants are safety professionals, or aviation's first responders in the last line of defense, and safety is not a variable item, so our compensation shouldn't be either. However, Frontier has been doing this for 3 years. Part of the reason that there was a change in policy is because the union called attention to tips that were not paid out to the flight attendants. And the change in policy is really to provide a more transparent process. If Frontier is going to have this, then it needs to be transparent, and they need to be not holding on to any of those tips. So that's why there's a change in policy. But fundamentally, we are absolutely opposed to tipping. It undermines the role of flight attendants, and we don't believe that any other airline is interested in taking this up. And so we're going to make sure that that doesn't happen, and in the meantime, fight very hard for a contract that's meaningful. I heard Leslie speaking earlier about the compensation for Frontier flight attendants, and I'll just add a little color to that. The Frontier flight attendants are vastly underpaid and have far reduced work rules compared with their counterparts in the industry. And their direct competitor at Spirit, where we have a really very good flight attendant contract. The Frontier contract is based on Frontier's bankruptcy. It lags far behind the rest of the industry. And Frontier has really been making money off the flight attendants' backs for way too long. So they, in some cases, they're 20 and 30% behind the contract at Spirit. And their work rules are way behind the quality of life and the work rules around giving flight attendants some flexibility on the job.
One of the things I guess I've always thought, and you know, I don't mind tipping, but I felt it would be kind of insulting to tip a flight attendant for the reasons that you suggest, that it to me sort of made it as though they're food and beverage servers as opposed to the multifaceted part of it. And I wonder, is that true that there are flight attendants who would feel insulted or just accepted in the spirit of it being given?
Well, look, there's a lot of tipping workers who do some really important work for us in this country. We wouldn't get delivered our meals or get taken care of in the restaurants. But
driven places, which is important too, yeah.
Is on the aircraft to serve as a safety professional. And it does undermine our authority in the cabin because safety has to be number one. And you don't, I mean, imagine that you could take this to a really ridiculous place and you could say, you know, I'm going to tip my flight attendant in an emergency and make sure that she makes sure that I'm the first one off the plane. So it's just not an environment where you want to enter this, this variable payment by the passengers. And in addition to that, it's sort of in line with what Frontier has been doing more so than any other airline with passing costs on to the passengers. So is this just another attempt by Frontier to pass the cost of paying the flight attendants to the passengers? We're opposed to it for all of those reasons. Mm. And we believe very strongly that there simply needs to be a good contract with good pay and benefits and protections on the job for aviation's first responders.
Pippi writes on the page, on long flights, I do take treats for the flight attendants, individually wrapped snack bars, for example, but I'd never give them cash tips. I'm paying enough for the flight. And we have Dinesh in Fullerton says, I'm a frequent flyer with Delta because I appreciate their service, and I see the same attendants over and over. I do tip flight attendants, but I don't think airlines need to encourage that. Airlines need to pay attendants. That's Dinesh in Fullerton. We'll take calls as we continue. Our lines are open at 866-893-KPCC, and I'm very interested in hearing from flight attendants. What do you think of this? Would you like to see your airline formalize the process of flight attendants accepting tips? How do you take it when a passenger offers a tip? Are you grateful, or do you feel in any way it diminishes the different aspects of your job? 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Stacey Abrams, who lost the race for governor of Georgia, has been chosen by Democrats to give the State of the Union response. I don't believe she's holding any current office. I can't ever remember a time when someone who's not holding office as a Democrat gave the rebuttal in the State of the Union address. That's interesting. That just announced. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle talking about whether flight attendants should formalize the process of accepting tips. There are people who tip flight attendants currently. Frontier Airlines, for the past 3 years, has had a formal process. You know, when the tablet goes up and down the aisle for any purchase, they can tip the flight attendant, and that's now going to be pooled. We're at 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page. Robert, in the Mid-Wilshire District, you're on Air Talk.
Times have so changed, okay? Spent about a half dozen years as a number cruncher at several major airlines, and we looked at the concept of personal gratuities, and the conclusion we had as the airline was getting rid of a labor leader from the flight attendants union, JFK, was that that's corruption. You take that, it's corruption, which falls under the interference with the duties of a flight, you know, safety crew.
Is it corrupt or a violation of the law for flight attendants to take tips?
Because they're there with a train, as your previous speaker mentioned, they're there trained as professional safety people. They have responsibilities to the entire airline passenger group, and to have people selectively trying to nudge, wink, wink, by passing out cash to the flight attendants. Why don't you pass out cash to the TSA people, too? You know, maybe it'll get you through the line quicker.
So it'd be the equivalent of tipping a public safety employee, is what you're saying. All right. I appreciate it, Robert. Thanks very much. Sarah Nelson, International President of the Association of Flight Attendants, your thoughts on Robert's point.
I think Robert is right on. And it's also concerning to us, I should say, that, you know, we've been taking on the issue of sexual harassment this year, and we know for a fact that people who are tipped are more likely sexually harassed. There's an undermining there of their position when people feel like they can sort of own them with by holding them accountable for how they're going to respond to the customer based on how much they're going to pay them. And it's you really shouldn't have that kind of relationship in a safety environment where the safety professional is having to keep order, having to keep an order so that everyone is safe on the plane and everyone has an equal experience and an equal opportunity to that safety. You don't want to have tips involved in that to undermine that very clear process of serving as a public safety official.
Sue, in Studio City, I understand you've been a flight attendant for 4 decades. That's very impressive. Share with us your thoughts about this.
Well, I agree. We need to remember why we all got hired. I'm a safety professional. Yes, I do serve drinks. Yes, I do serve food. But to me, it's almost an insult to my profession.
Yeah, and I assume that the way in which a tip is offered, you also factors into it. Are there any that you didn't feel right about that you didn't accept?
Oh, lots of times. Lots and lots of times. I mean, passengers do offer tips, and it's been over the 40-year span that something exceptional has happened and whatever the case may be. But as a general rule, people don't offer tips. You know, they would write a good letter or something like that, which is really more than enough. I'm not there for tips.
All right. So, Sue, are you comfortable saying what airline you fly for?
American.
And have they come out, has the company come out with a policy about this?
We got rid of the go-go boots a long time ago.
Yeah. So has American come out and said, you know, we discourage tipping?
They've never said we discourage tipping. Technically, we are not allowed to accept them, but also technically we're not allowed to anger the passenger either. We shouldn't make it so elevated that they get upset about it.
All right. Sue, I don't know if you started with it. Did you start when the go-go boots were part of the uniform?
Yep, that was one of my very first uniforms.
Did you save them as a memory or let those go?
I have my first uniform and my first paycheck.
All right. Very good. Well, Sue, congratulations on your long career as a flight attendant for American. Thanks so much for joining us. Let's see. Let me share some other comments here. Jay tweets at AirTalk, Delta has a program where you can gift kudos miles to flight attendants or any staff if you feel they went above and beyond. These miles don't come from the passenger, but from the airline. Gerald messages us on the AirTalk Facebook page, no tipping flight attendants. Frontier needs to pay a living wage. Airlines in general, but especially discount airlines, are already charging for every single stage of the flying process, from seat selection to boarding, even charge for carry-on. Just charge a fee that covers and cut out the deceptive nonsense. I personally hate discount airlines because they end up costing the same and providing less. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Olivia in Burbank says, my mom was an American flight attendant. She always said she didn't want to accept tips, but gifts like chocolate, snacks, trinkets, greatly appreciated. That's Olivia sharing her mother's perspective on it. My thanks to the International President of the Association of Flight Attendants, Sarah Nelson. Thank you so much for talking about your members of 50,000 strong. We appreciate it. And thanks to CNBC
CNBC reporter covering airlines, Leslie Josephs. Stay tuned. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next on 89.3. Terry's guest will be memoirist Stephanie Land, who writes about her life after fleeing an abusive relationship and cleaning houses for a living. Fresh Air with Terry Gross next here on 89.3. And remember, Take Two with A. Martinez. It's brand new time, 2 o'clock weekday afternoons here on 89.3.